Okay, Hans is sick today, so I'm chairing. And so we're starting with agenda paper 29, and I hand over to... the AO office.
John, can you hear us?
Handing over to you.
Yes, we can hear you. Thank you.
We're ready for you to start.
Let's start. Kuniyoshi's going to kick off for us.
Okay. Well, agenda paper 29 discusses a board proposal for classification of liability as current or non-current. Today, we'd like to ask you whether you think the board should revise any of the exposure draft proposal in light of the staff analysis of the implication of the proposal for particular facts and circumstances identified by the students, or potential differences between the exposure draft proposal and the similar proposals being developed by FASB. First, we'd like to ask you to discuss the implication of the proposal for facts and circumstances identified by respondents. The staff analysis of the implication is summarized in paragraph 13. There is a further discussion of matters arising in paragraph 15 to 25. The staff recommendation and question start at paragraph 26. So starting with question one, the staff recommend that, as proposed in the exposure draft, IS-1 should require an entity to classify a liability as current if the entity does not have a right at the end of the reporting period to defer settlement of the liability for at least 12 months after the reporting period. Do you agree? Moving to question two.
Just stop with that one, yeah.
Okay, so starting with question one. Mary?
Hi, I have a question that relates to what guidance we might give about making the assessment of a test that has to be made after the reporting date. So let's say you're December 31st year end, and you have a covenant that requires testing compliance at March 15th. Okay, and you know, we say here, and I agree with the concept, that you make the assessment based on the circumstances at December 31st, which is the reporting date. My question is how, you know, I think we should comment, my observation is not a question, that I think we should comment about how you do that. And what I mean by that is if it's, let's say, to the extent that there are any covenant tests that, let's say, require performance figures or cumulative figures for a 12-month period, do you look at the 12 months ended 31st December as if that were the testing date? Or do you say for the 9.5 months to December 31st, where are we versus the 12-month targets that are going to be tested March 15th? It's more a question for any tests that are based on the statement of performance rather than the statement of financial position. I agree with the staff proposal that we, you know, with saying you test it at the reporting date, but I just think we have to go one step further and say which of those two approaches you take when you have tests that are based on, let's say, performance figures for a 12-month period.
Okay. Thanks, Mary. Chung-Woo?
Thank you. Just a small clarification. On paragraph 13B, the one, that's the concept of a potentially uneconomic. If their terms are such that their apparent right to roll over the liability lacks substance, unless that lacks substance, then potentially uneconomic the kind of concept does not affect the classification, right? And at the paragraph 15, you said some of these outcomes might look counterintuitive. However, our purpose is to keep this classification under the concept of the end of reporting period. But if you go to the 17, paragraph 17, we are talking about these two concepts in this paragraph there. Even that the terms of rollover are potentially uneconomic, however, our conclusion is subject to caveat, blah, 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 must have substance. So these three paragraphs are related on the concept of potentially uneconomic. However, I'm just a little curious about the relationship between this potentially uneconomic and some kind of a substance, lacking of substance concept. So what I'm saying is even if there is a very uneconomic, then that might indicate a kind of a lacking of substance. So that means that might affect our classification of a current and non-current. Is that right?
Do you mean lack of substance in the more extreme thinking that we would typically use, as opposed to not just because it's, you know, slightly more expensive than normal, the market prices or out of the money today, it doesn't necessarily mean it doesn't have substance. That's a bigger deal. Is that the distinction you'd make?
I think that's the point we were trying to make, was that it's not just that, it's got to be that it more in the sort of the way that it's in IAS 32, it's quite an extreme thing. It just couldn't ever be the right thing to do, because it just wouldn't work in any circumstances, so has no meaning within the contract. And so it's far more than just potentially uneconomic. So that was the point we were trying to get out, exactly what you say, Sue.
So that means
it's something that's it's in theory the right exists, but that the terms are, to use an extreme, so ridiculous it's unimaginable there'd be a scenario when the entity would actually exercise that right. I think that's the sort of thinking. Is that a fair articulation? I'm trying to be careful with my choice of words.
And probably both parties to the contract know that from the outset. They'd know that this was something that wasn't ever going to be invoked.
Now, Mary,
does that help?
Okay.
Mary, you put your card up. Was that in response to this, or should I let Gary in because he's next in terms of queuing?
It's in response to this, but he may want to comment on this too, so I can come back.
Are you happy if Mary responds directly to Chung Wei?
No, go ahead. Okay. Let's just close that issue.
Yep. Okay. I was kind of holding that for question two, which is why I didn't comment now. But I think we have to be very careful with how we express this, because while I agree with the staff proposal that a non-substantive term should not impact the determination of current, non-current, I think given everything we've struggled with in terms of expression around economic compulsion in our financial instruments with characteristics of equity project, that maybe I just want to urge caution about the drafting and think about whether you need to bring something back to the board or whether it's just something that you handle in drafting. I think there are a couple of things. We have the conceptual framework, which makes the statement about in needing to have substance. And I think there's an overall theme in this paper that's quite useful that we should pick up, which is this is based on the rights and obligations that the entity has. It's not intended to be a prediction. It's not intended to be intent-based. And I think in the context of that kind of discussion, we can bring out this issue of should you reflect economic incentives or not? And I think the answer we're saying is no, it's not a prediction of what is going to happen. It is what are, the classification is based on the entity's rights and obligations. Mm-hmm. I was not particularly keen on the proposal in question two that we just make a comment about substance, because it's the same thing as with materiality. If we make the comment some places but not others, it almost undercuts the overarching principle. But I take your point, you know, in the paper that there is that I think we need to bring out this. It's not intent. It's not forecast. It's not probability. It's based on rights and obligations. And in that context, I could see some limited discussion referring perhaps to the conceptual framework about this point.
Okay, and based on 19B, it's not that unusual that we actually do say it specifically at standards level.
Well, just an additional comment. The Mary said there are kind of an implication of our new conceptual framework, but today we have another paper, the implication of a new conceptual framework on the issue in IFRS 3. But currently, this paper is, we are doing everything under the old conceptual framework. So
I'm not sure that that's really changed much in the framework, though.
No, I think
it hasn't really changed.
There was an explicit reference to substance over form was incorporated into the new conceptual framework, but the old conceptual framework already had that concept in there. Yeah. If you read in the basis, it explained that there was no explicit reference because faithful representation is supposed to encompass substance over form as well.
Okay.
Gary, thank you. You've been very patient.
I'm just always patient, you know. And this is trying my patience, but I am going to start by saying I agree with Mary's first comment, which I really hate to do. but I think back to the thing about when you do the year-end compliance test, I mean, your example, I think, say March 15th, that the computation's done as factors and the place at March 15th, which is different from... It's a year-end test that's due to be submitted by March 15th. They're slightly different, but in any event, I think at the end of the day, it's still just an assessment or an estimate or something is what you're closing the books on, and that doesn't make it any more remarkable than all the other estimates. I mean, you don't true up your tax provision to file a return a year later. You don't true up your actuarial liability until many months later. So it's just one of many estimates and judgments and things you assess. But I do think it's worth saying that it's an estimate or assessment or something like that. And I would probably go on to say it's based on the best information readily available as of December 31st or as of your normal closed process. In the end, I don't think it's all that big of a deal because if you're that tight on the debt covenants, it's being watched really carefully, and you can do certain actions before the 31st of December. You securitize some receivables, just pay down some debt, you know, for example, if you had to. So I think it's an issue, but I don't think it will be a common issue, or in any event, it will not be a surprise of an issue if it's that type.
Okay. All right, with that, can we vote then on question one?
13, one absent.
Okay, thank you. You want to, we need to discuss question two. Are you going to tee up question two, or can we go straight on and see if the board's got comments?
Yep, just carry on. Thank you.
Thank you. Any comments, or can we vote on two? Okay, vote on question two. Show of hands.
Anne?
Did you want to comment?
Yeah, did want to comment because I felt that we had a point raised that we haven't dealt with, and that was I think was Mary's point, that you know, do we make this specific mention here, or do we think about the fact that if we have overarching requirements elsewhere, do we then actually add them into standards as well?
Okay.
I thought that was a good point, and there's been no further discussion on it, so I wasn't really sure which way, because in principle I would say that we do, like we do with materiality, we don't mention it in every standard. I'm not sure why we have to
I agree
talk about substance here. There might be a reason, and that's what I'd like to know about.
And I guess maybe the staff can respond, but one thing I did mention in passing was, if you look at paragraph 19b, actually it's not at all uncommon that we do specifically refer to substance. We do it a lot.
Right, okay.
Yeah.
So that was...
So it wouldn't be unique.
Was
that what you were going
to
say?
Yeah. Okay.
So with those with those points in mind, and thanks, Anne, for pausing and making sure we think about it. Question two, can we get a show of hands?
12-1 absent.
Okay. All right. Handing back to the staff. Okay, so, introduce question three? Sorry, go.
Can I move to question three?
Yeah.
So question 3A, do you agree that Annex 1 should clarify the matter set out in paragraph 29? And question 3B, do you agree that Annex 1 should not clarify any other matter discussed in this paper?
Yeah, thank you. Just a question. In paragraph 29A1, it says it is not affected by the management expectation about whether the entity will exercise that right. However, if you look at the actual exposure draft on page 22, 69A, it says an entity shall classify the liability as a current when it expects to settle the liability in its normal operating cycle. So this is actually the current wording. So just let me, could you clarify the difference between what you are saying in the paragraph 29A1 and the paragraph 69A of the exposure draft?
Yes, I think what we had in mind was that the reference to expectations would apply to paragraph 69D only.
Only?
So it's about whether if the entity has a right to defer settlement, the classification wouldn't depend on whether it expected to exercise that right or not. So there would be a difference. But there is an inherent difference between paragraph 69A and 69D anyway. And that reference we would add would apply only to 69D.
Okay. So the difference is whether or not it's an operating cycle. That D is about the settlement. Am I right?
D is really about liabilities that the entity might have a right to defer settlement of, because they're more loan-like with settlement dates and bank book type agreements.
So it has nothing to do with operation. It's just simply the matter of settlement, whether or not. When you have a liability, it is simply the matter of settlement. But the difference is in the 69A, I'm not 100% sure. So it expects to settle the liability in normal operating cycle. And Not 100% clear what is really the difference.
Is A dealing with things that are undated? Is that the point you're making, Joan?
I think so.
Undated.
D is specific.
So it doesn't have a formal maturity date.
Okay, I understand. Right. Thank you.
Okay, thanks. Gary?
There's some questions at background 29 as well, just to kind of, I'm not sure I understand the intent here. So Joan, if I start in 29A, just to make sure I understand the point, clarifying that entity's intent, right to defer settlement is not affected. When you say right to defer settlement mean it's otherwise due, but I have an option to extend it? What do we mean by that?
Yes.
We have already the words in paragraph 69D that talks about it not having a right to defer settlement. And I think that is referring to liabilities where the entity it's contractually entitled to defer settlement for more than 12 months. So it may have an option to settle earlier, but it has a right to go longer.
Okay, now, is that right separate from a maturity or due date?
I guess it could be if there's a... So that there be... I don't know. It has to be, or it doesn't have to be, really.
Okay. Because as I go down into little I and little I two, so I have the right to defer. So that presumes I can book it non-current. But I have an expectation to pay it currently. And the settlement occurs before the financial statements are issued. But isn't that also I'm exercising? I have two rights in there. I can pay it or I cannot pay it. I mean, that's also a right that I've got in there is to pay it. So I don't know why. So I'm not sure what we do with this.
But my understanding of how it works, and Joan, I'm just doing this because of the time delay, it's just slightly easier, excuse me, is that if you had a situation where, say, there was a maturity date, in inverted commas, it was in 6 months' time, but the entity had the right to defer for a further 12 months, even if they intended not to exercise that right, and even if, actually, after the financial statements were issued, they chose to repay it in 6 months, we would say that was not current because, as at the date of the financial statements, it was within their control to they couldn't be required to pay it back. It was within their control to extend it beyond 12 months if they chose to do so. And we're saying you don't need to think about whether or not they're likely to choose to pay back or whether they'll make use of the right. And even if they went so far as knowing that they had chosen to pay it back, our analysis is it within their control whether or not it's longer than 12 months? Is that correct, Joan?
Yes. Yes.
But if it's in their control to be longer than 12 months or in their control to be shorter than 12 months, I don't know why management expectations and actions wouldn't factor in.
Yeah. I think that the proposal and what's in the ED, and I think it's consistent with the logic that was in IAS-1, as I understand it, before we even put the ED out, was we focus on, is it within entity's control to choose the date and it becomes current if it's not within their control?
Mm-hmm. Well, but in this case, it would be in their control, so you could make it current or non-current. Yeah. It really is driven by
expectations. But as long as they can put off the evil day beyond 12 months, IS-1 says it's okay, you don't have to classify it as current.
But if I wanted to classify it as current, because I will pay it, can you, under this?
But that's also true, I guess. If I have a five-year loan, I can often prepay it tomorrow.
Yeah, no.
But I'd still say it's
I'm just having trouble. There's a lot of double negatives in this. Yeah. I'm just trying to understand it.
So
but what's happening is if you have the right but not the obligation, it's current or non-current depending on your intent.
Yep, absolutely.
Okay,
yep.
If that's
I think the principle underpinning this is the idea that can you actually be forced to pay? Yeah. And so that's what drives a non-current classification.
If you're forced to pay, it would be current.
If you could be forced to
pay,
say
I can't be current. I've got the right. What does this mean?
You've got the right to extend.
You have the right to settle it in more than 12 months' time, and therefore you classify it as non-current. So it's about what you can be forced to do rather than...
Yeah. Can I be forced to repay in the next 12 months?
But I'm back to if I want to repay.
If I want to, that doesn't affect the classification.
That's the management expectation. Yeah. It will not affect. That is what... 29.
Well, if the Minister's Secretary will not affect, then means words have got to govern as opposed to intent.
Yes.
Yes.
Which is what we're trying to clarify.
Right, but the intent here, the words would say, is I really have a choice. I can defer or not defer.
And
or if expectation does not factor into, I either got to pick the earliest date or the latest date that's available to me.
And I think what we're trying to say is that you look at the latest date in terms of the current, non-current classification. Now, and this goes to the point that we made, that in some cases this may seem like a counterintuitive answer, that, you know, you have the right to settle it earlier than the 12 months, and actually you intend to settle it earlier than the 12 months. But I think it's consistent with the way in which IS1 has been operating for a number of years. I don't think this is actually a change. I think it is just a clarification. Is that right, Joan?
This is from paragraph 69D, and it doesn't change paragraph 69D. So it's something that has been in IS1. It's not new from the exposure draft.
Well, okay, but I probably would have voted against that then too, you know. But seriously, if something can be, you have the option, the right, whatever, to pay it, and the contract allows you to pay it 13 months or longer, but I pay it earlier, I have to say in January, I have to carry it as non-current.
Yeah.
I don't agree with that.
Okay. Mary?
I'm just going to offer the view that I thought it was important that we say that this is based on the rights and the obligations, not the intent.
Yep.
So that even though, you know, Gary, prudent manager that he is, once, you know, intends to pay the debt off in the next 6 months and he has that right, I think it should be classified as non-current because he's not obliged to do so. So I think it's important that we keep consistent with both practice
but this is not a case where I can be forced. I have the right to do something.
Yeah.
I'm sorry. I don't agree, but whatever.
We have always a right.
Yeah.
We could
let it go.
Yeah.
Okay. Let's try and vote. Question 3A. Do you agree with we should clarify what's set out in paragraph 29?
12, 1 absent.
And then
3B, do you agree that we shouldn't clarify the other matters that are discussed in the paper?
Mm. 13, 1 absent.
Okay, thank you.
Sue?
Daryl?
So I agree with all the answers.
Not reopening
I'm
the voting.
I'm very comfortable not opening any of the voting. Good. But I just wanted to check with staff what the intention is to do with the examples that you've included in Appendix A, and whether you see those being included in any final drafting or basis or anything like that.
So that's the Appendix A?
Appendix A
discussion.
Does Appendix A have a life beyond this paper?
We had no intention to include the examples in anything else. They were there just because they were the examples that the respondents had raised, and we used them to just test the proposal. So we would not be intending to use them for anything else.
Thanks.
All right. Handing back to you to tee up the next section.
Okay, let's move on to the next topic, the potential differences between exposure draft and FSR. Some aspects of the FASB proposal potentially differ from the exposure draft proposal. These are discussed in the paragraph 34 to 46 of this paper. They relate to waivers of debt covenant violations, grace period granted, and unused long-term financing arrangements. The first two were identified and explained in the previous staff paper, but the last one is a new potential difference arising from a very recent tentative decision by the FASB. The staff thinks that if the ISB were to align the exposure draft proposal on these three aspects with the FASB's proposals, it would be adding exceptions that changed and add complexity to IS1 requirements. So moving to question 4, following paragraph 47. The staff recommend that the board should not consider the further amendment to IS-1 in light of differences between the requirements of IS-1 and the proposed requirements on classification of debt being developed for U.S. GAAP by FASB. Do you agree?
Any comments?
Yes. I have a slight concern with the divergence of ISB. Before we vote, let me clarify whether the divergence is significant or not. And I guess looking at the divergence you picked up, it seems like just exceptions. So I would guess this is not quite significant. If the exceptions are applied not too much frequent. And so my question is, I would like to know that the is it significant practice? I mean, there are lots of exceptions applied in the U.S. in practice. And then that could cause a significant divergence outcome or not. Do you have any idea?
I don't think we know how frequently these exceptions are applied, but my guess is that they are used in practice because if they weren't being used in practice, I don't think the FASB would have felt the need to include them.
Mm. But may I understand the principle of the standard is converged, is basically the same?
The principle is converged, yes.
So then it's a matter of practice rather than principle.
It's a matter of practice in certain particular areas, but yeah, the principle is the same. And most aspects of the requirements are the same. So there's only these three very, very specific exceptions.
Okay, thank you.
Some of which were differences that already existed.
Yeah.
Anne?
Joan, my question was about the proposed nature of these. I assume that they are proposals that you expect to go through, and that's why we're concerning ourselves with them.
The first two, I think, are fairly well established now. They were tentative decisions of the FASB that were made some time ago. The final one on unused long-term financing arrangements, we don't know because the FASB has discussed this one on several occasions and had different decisions on different decisions, and it's still researching it. So that's probably the one that's least stable as to exactly whether or what will go ahead.
Okay, thank you.
Tom?
Just on this issue of exceptions, just in general, I think the staff have done a good job of writing this consistent with a conceptual framework and with principles-based. And we want to be principles-based. And while I think the distinction between principles and rules is somewhat more complex than a lot of people say, and that they're not entirely incompatible, I think exceptions are unequivocally rules that are incompatible with principles. So while we may want to harmonize long term, I don't think we should ever harmonize on what is an exception and what's generating a rule. So I like the way the staff has approached it.
That's good.
And I like the last question four.
Okay. All right, with that, can we vote on question four, please?
12, 2 absent.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Okay.